The Last Dance podcast on the ESPN Chicago app. It's Carmen and Sylvie, and this is the unanswered questions edition of the Last Dance recap. Now, Sylvie's got to be like in the top three in Chicago sports of the biggest Bulls fans out there. He's certainly numero uno here at the station. I think one of the few things that Sylvie and I used to fight about over the years was the Bulls, their direction.
And Ben Gordon.
Ben Gordon, Antonio Davis. I mean, do you remember some of the silly arguments we used to have?
Well, you liked the leadership that Antonio Davis provided.
I did.
I thought it was a waste of a roster spot.
I was talking about this with Yerk the other day on the air about all the mistakes they made coming out of the lockout. And how bad things had gotten by 2003 when they finally decided to move on from Kraus. And so I specifically referenced the famous fights we used to have about it. Antonio Davis. And I said, Pax only was trying to find guys that could teach these young players a thing or two because Kraus had made such a mess of the roster. They were so young. They had really no veteran leadership, no voice, nobody to lean on. They had terrible practice habits. Nobody really held them accountable. And that's why they tried to bring in guys that could show them a thing or two. It's ironic that Jerry Reinsdorf decided to give Scottie Pippen $10.5 million at the end of his career for like 30 games just because they were so desperate to see if Scottie could get through to Tyson and Eddie. And of course, that never really happened either. I mean, it was so mismanaged in those years. It was
this
terrible.
Is why I wanted to do the podcast because I when I listened to you, Carmen, I heard you tell the Scottie Pippen story with the last couple of years on his contract and how he got overpaid and the Davis story and all that stuff. It's like, I need to talk to Carmen. We only get like 10-15 minutes in the crosstalk part, and not all of it's on the Last Dance. So I'm like, we got to have a reunion, and we need to get into the studio. And I feel like there are so many arguments that still haven't been settled. And now with Horace Grant saying what he said, I think it's fueling it even more.
Yeah, I mean, like, man, you talk about stoking the flames here. I mean, 30 years later, it's crazy what this has brought back up to the surface. All right, so you have a bunch of questions, you said, right? I've got a few. You, of course, have more because this stuff for you, I mean, nothing gets your blood boiling like the Bulls.
It pisses me off.
I know it does. So you've got, like, what, seven questions, you said?
So I was just thinking, I'm like, okay, I want to do this podcast with Carm. Here are still the questions to me that are unanswered that I don't have a true answer on coming out of 10 episodes of The Last Dance. And I thought Jason Hare did a great job, and you're never going to get true answers on everything. All right. So and I'm not ranking them.
All right.
So I'll read them off, and then when we could circle back and we can tackle whichever ones you want.
Okay.
Here are the top seven that came to my mind. Why is Michael Jordan so close with security guards but not fellow teammates? Why does Michael Jordan love vanity plates so much when he complains that he has no privacy?
Two tray.
Look, oh my God, it sucks to be me, but hey, look, everybody, I'm coming down the Edens.
That is so great.
Why does Scottie Pippen not regret 1.8? Why does Jerry Reinsdorf always side with the front office and never with his best Hall of Fame players like Phil Jackson, Michael Jordan, and Scottie Pippen? Why does he side with little Jerry Krause over Phil, Michael, and Scottie? And he's done that with Gar and Pax and the White Sox through the years. Where did the relationship between Phil and Krause go bad? Do we really appreciate Michael Jordan's final Bulls game performance? While we always look back to the final shot, and then we all get mad over, hey, that's the last shot ever, do we truly look at that moment and understand what he did in that game by scoring half his team's points, more than half, and doing what he did in the last 45 seconds of the game? I mean, has there truly been a better end of the game than that, and maybe a better game ever in a bigger moment? And was Horace Grant really the source for the Jordan rules? Those are the seven that I wrote down to me that I wanted to talk to my buddy Carmen DeFalco and figure out what the answers are to those. What do you have?
All right, let's start with number one because it's number two on my list. It was one on yours. It was two on mine, so that's probably a good place to start. And you phrased it something to the effect of, why was Michael so close with his security crew, but not really with his teammates. I wrote down, does Michael have any friends? And when I say that, I mean, or when I write it down, I mean, you know, truly the guys that he went to battle with, not just the guys that were protecting him, not some of the hangers-on, but does he truly have any teammates that were friends? Not that we ever expect these guys to all get along and always be best buddies, but normally, we've been around enough pro athletes to know, normally there are a few guys, no matter how big or small the dynamic is, depending on sport, you know, if you played in that professional arena, in that locker room, you've got a few guys that you are really, really close with. We've heard Waddle tell stories about it. We've heard Yurko. Varying degrees of success. You know, the grinders like Yurko and Waddle, all the way to the star players like Jimbo Covert or Mongo, you know. So why did Michael seem to struggle with that so much? I think it's a very good question. And you made the point the other day, on Monday, I think it was, what a bizarre scene on that documentary at the end to see Michael celebrating in his room, playing the piano, smoking a cigar, drinking champagne with people that we didn't really recognize, not the players.
Who the hell are those people? Who's the guy with the weird goatee and the red jacket? And then Merkin said Quinn Buckner's in there. Like, why? I mean, what? How is he such great friends with Quinn Buckner and not? Why isn't Scotty in the room? Where's Ron Harper? I know Dam and Dennis didn't hang out, but Waddle's got. I totally disagree with Waddle's theory. Waddle thinks that this was calculated, that he couldn't rip guys and be friends with them at the same time. I just think the ripping came first, and then no one really wanted to be friends with him.
Yeah.
And then I think that he MF'd all these players to his security staff. He wanted to MF Bill Cartwright. He wanted to MF Horace Grant. He wanted to MF Scott Burrell and so on and Steve Kerr. So he would MF and he would bond after these. And Michael's got a fun side, and he's so popular he couldn't go out with a lot of these guys. So this was the crew that he would have beers with and MF people behind closed doors. That's my theory.
I think that's a good one. I think that he's so friggin' competitive, and we've always known that. We learned it again. If you needed any reminder, you learned it through these last 5 weeks. He was so competitive in everything that he does. I don't think that it was ever okay with him to have someone that was on his level. You know what I mean? Like, he had no real peer. Nobody was as good as him. And how dare anybody think they're as good as him? If you were an opposing player, he was going to, as Andrew Hawkins says, bust your ass and give you 60. That was his mindset. That's what he was going to do. If you were a teammate and you dare think you could keep up with him in practice, or you could talk back, or you could talk trash, or you could shut him down, he was going to do the same thing. Like, he was always looking to eviscerate everybody. He had no equal. And so the constant, like, berating and the pushing, yeah, I think guys were just turned off by it. I don't think they wanted to be friends with Michael.
That's the thing. I remember, Carm, I'm going to offend some of the fraternity guys out there. Like, there was a time at Southern, I don't even know if I've told you this, there was a time at Southern that I thought it would be cool to be in a fraternity. But Southern did not have a big Greek system. So I decided to pledge a fraternity. And people are going to look at me like I backed out of it. And I did. Like, and there was like this one, my roommate and I did it, and we're pledging. And there's this one night where, like, they pick us up at our apartment and they blindfold us and they drive us around like Southern Illinois and they're doing stuff to us. And I'm thinking to myself, why the fuck would I want to hang out with any of these people? This is not fun. This is not the way I should be spending my Friday night. I should be in the bars right now getting drunk. And then they're always saying, well, what we're doing is we're teaching you how you unite with your fellow people that you're pledging with. And I'm like, screw that. I want no part of this. So I whatever it was, I said to my de-pledge or whatever, I'm like, this is not for me. So the point of the story is, Michael MF'd these guys so badly. Michael would whip basketballs at them to make a point that they couldn't catch his passes. That he, on the plane, I'm going to take away your food.
Yeah.
That he was such a dick to all these guys that I don't think they even really wanted to hang out with him in a social environment.
I don't think they could stand him. They made you play Ookie Cookie, didn't they? I think they did. Oh, I don't think I've ever heard that story either.
Hey, it's a, and I've known you a long time.
Blindfolded in the back of a car.
I mean, I'm like, what the what's going on here? This is fun? This is fraternity life?
Glad I had nothing to do with it. I'd go down to visit my brother at U of I, and he was a member of a fraternity. And my youngest brother, too, at Iowa. I didn't go see him as much. I was already working at that point. But I got to
more
see
of a bond.
The fraternity life that way was good enough for me. Yeah. All right. You brought up a good point about the vanity plates. Like, why does Michael say that he is oh so private? But meantime, and I thought the same thing you did while we saw a few of the shots, the video footage of his cars, whether it was the Range Rover, two tray, or the Porsche, which was awesome, Air, or when you drive to his house in Highland Park, there's a big 2-3 on the gate. Are you kidding me? Letting everybody know, hey, this is Michael Jordan's compound. Like, why say that you're so private, but then you've got these vanity plates like that that's announcing to everybody, hey, look at me. Here comes Michael Jordan down the Edens.
It's like your one private moment. Like, it's so weird to see him smoking a cigar before a game, you know, filling his lungs up with smoke before he's playing. But, like, it's your one private moment where, yeah, you're in traffic, but at least you're alone with the 1,000 other commuters, and you could be fairly anonymous. I mean, yeah, you're driving a Range Rover or a Porsche or the Blazer in the early days, but here's my philosophy on this, Carm. Meller actually said on our show, I don't know if you heard this, Meller said that he would rather be Jeff Meller than Michael Jordan. And I said, well, you're crazy. You may have a good life, and I'm saying that you could transfer your wife and your kids if you're Michael. So this isn't about, well, I love my kids and I don't want anyone else's kids. I truly believe while Michael complains about privacy, no one loves being himself more than Michael Jordan. That Michael Jordan, we caught him twice. Reggie Miller told the story that Michael looked at him during a game and said, never talk that way to Black Jesus.
Yeah.
And there was an episode earlier when he's hanging out with security and he knows he's being filmed and they mentioned Jesus. And Michael said, you're looking at him, or something to that effect. And then he goes, I'm just joking. The cameras are here. I truly believe that while he complained about privacy, no one wanted to be Michael Jordan more, and no one wanted you to know that he was Michael Jordan more than him.
The God complex. That's interesting. Yeah, it wants everybody to know, hey, I am Black Jesus. Do you think, I mean, I do think it'd be hard to live that way. I mean, when you, you know, I thought Jason Hare was good when he was talking to you guys the other day about Michael and the whole friendship thing. And he said, you know, he was, maybe he was always a dick to his teammates, and that's why they didn't really want much to do with him. But I thought he made a salient point when he said Michael really just couldn't go find Scotty in the lobby after a game or before, you know, the night they got into a city and say, hey, let's go get a steak. Like, that couldn't happen. Scotty, as popular as he was, could do that. That wasn't going to happen with Michael. And I do think that would be a hard way to live, where everything's got to be planned out ahead of time and security needs to get you in and out. And
what
the cops
can't Michael do in life that we do?
He can't go to the movies. I mean, he can't just go to a movie.
I mean, really, Carm. Okay, so you have a choice. You can go to the movie theater, sit with a bunch of people. You're fighting over the armrest with some dude to your left.
They don't have armrests anymore. They got
all right,
chairs
whatever it
now.
Is. All right, but that,
you don't go
the
to
guy
movies
to your
enough.
Left. The guy to your left is the loud laugher. He's got to turn to the wife and say, oh, that was so good. That was so good. And you've got to wait for your popcorn. Or you could live in a mansion with your own theater. You could be Michael Jordan and get first-run movies delivered to your house that you can only see at the movie theater. Which setup do you want more?
I like going to the movies, though.
Oh, but that's bullshit.
I do. Listen, I do think it'd be hard to constantly, everywhere you go, people want a piece of you. But... like, does any athlete that says, oh, I truly want my privacy, mean it? Or do they all have some of what you just said about Michael? Like, that desire for everybody to know, this is how I live, this is who I am, I'm Black Jesus. Like, do you think Tiger is serious about his privacy? Or are they all full of shit? And, like, they all crave the spotlight.
Don't you think, while Tiger's weird, too, they're all weird. And don't get me wrong, I love Michael, and I'm Team Michael, and I wouldn't want a documentary. Like, all this stuff about, well, this is only what Michael wanted you to see. Well, that's who I wanted to hear from. He never talks. He was the greatest athlete ever. He's given us 6 championships as Chicago sports fans. You think I want more Trent Tucker and less Michael Jordan?
No.
You think I want more Stacey? Nothing against Stacey, and less Michael. Like, I want more Michael. I could take zoom out and say Michael's weird, and Michael's got this, like, there's faults that, and thank God that we see Michael's faults, because, you know, too often we looked at him as this black Jesus on the court, and we didn't think he's got lots of faults, and I think it is being exposed during the Last Dance.
Where did it all go wrong between Jerry Krause and Phil Jackson? That was another one of your questions, and I think that's a good one. Jerry Krause, I think, at every turn wanted Phil to announce to the world, hey, let's start this press conference by me reminding everybody that Jerry Krause plucked me out of Puerto Rico in the CBA when nobody wanted to touch me. Thank you very much, Jerry Krause. And that wasn't going to happen, whether it was true or not. We know it was true. That was never going to happen. Phil, at some point, had achieved and earned enough where he was sort of out on his own. But where did it start to deteriorate, you think? And I mean, this is why it's one of these unanswered questions.
Like, what do you think?
Was there a moment in time? I don't know. I really don't. Like, was there a singular moment? Was it the culmination of a bunch of things? Like, I don't know where it would have been. I think that Jerry continued to grow resentful when Phil wouldn't defend him against Michael and Scotty's ribbing and constant bullying. But, like, was there one singular moment, or did he just wake up one day in 1991 and say, I've had it, I can't believe Phil doesn't defend? I don't know. I mean,
I have two theories. No one in life likes the guy who has terrible personnel skills. He may be good at his job, but you're working with his coworkers, and this guy is so socially awkward, and he's such a slob. And he constantly reminds you that, hey, remember, I'm the one who got you this job. You know, it's always, hey, remember. Remember when you didn't wear the tie to Stan Albeck's interview? Hey, remember. And so he's so bad personnel skills-wise. And then on the flip side of that, Phil, I covered Phil for 4 seasons. Phil Jackson has a huge ego. And Phil Jackson would love to remind people that he's Phil Jackson. I'm effing Phil Jackson. And I think those two things combined, where I'm this guy who is so weird, and I'm reminding you all the time that I got you the job. And then there's the egomaniac in Phil, who, and then Phil, to his credit, also the second part of that is Phil knew where his bread was buttered. Even though Jerry got him his job, Phil was going to win games and championships because of Michael and Scotty. So when Michael and Scotty had feuds with the front office, he could side with the front office, like Jerry Reinsdorf and Krause would want him to do, or he could side with the guys who was winning games for him. And he chose winning games, and that made Krause resentful, and that eventually tore things apart.
Keep your players happy. I guess that's the point, right? Like, if you're Phil, keep the players happy.
Jerry Krause isn't going to hit a shot over Craig Elo.
No, he's not. I doubt he could get off the floor to even be able to attempt to hit that shot over Craig Elo. Why did Jerry Reinsdorf always side with the front office? That was another thing you said. I think Jerry Reinsdorf, like most owners, view the players, even the greatest player of all time, as just simple commodities, in a sense, that the players are always changing franchises, that Michael, just no matter how great he was, and he was the greatest, at some point was going to be old and wasn't going to be able to do the amazing feats of athleticism and accomplish everything he accomplished on the basketball court forever. That I think Jerry just operates as a very pragmatic businessman, and he views the players as interchangeable parts, but the people that are in his front office are there for the long haul. Those are his confidants. Those are the ones that he could pit against players in contract disputes and things like that. That's why Jerry Reinsdorf chooses the side of management, I think, and maybe not so much more today, because players have sort of accumulated more power, I guess, in sports, and certainly in basketball, where that singular player can make such a difference. But Jerry's a little bit more old school, and certainly back then in the 90s thought, come 35, when these guys can't play anymore, they'll be of no use to me, and Jerry Krause will still be of use to me. And that's why he sided with Jerry Krause.
I think it's the biggest mystery in Chicago sports, Carm, about not just in this moment, but this moment is what we're talking about. That Jerry Reinsdorf has done that through his entire career with the White Sox and with the Bulls. That no matter what, you know, John Paxson could turn a blind eye when Gar is hiring Fred Hoiberg and they had no coaches search. They have a fallout with Tibbs, and then you fire Tibbs and you hire Hoiberg without conducting a search. And then when that doesn't turn out, that's a fireable offense. But instead, they let him hire Jim Boylan. And again, without a coaching search and without an interim tag. And you can go to one Eastern Conference Finals in 17 years and win one Eastern Conference Final game in 17 years and still have a job. Pac still is employed.
Yeah.
But you could be Michael Jordan winning your fifth MVP, your sixth championship, the reigning champion, and you could rationalize that we're moving on from you. And I never understand that, whether it's Kenny Williams' fallout with Frank or Kenny Williams, some of the bad decisions he made with signings and trades and mediocrity, that they could keep those guys and he can easily say goodbye to Frank Thomas and Robin Ventura and Jack McDowell and, you know, Wilson Alvarez and all these guys, and with the Bulls, with Michael and Scotty and Phil, and just always remain loyal to these guys who performed worse in the front office.
Maybe Jerry was a little bit afraid that Michael would be a threat to his ownership at some point, too. Like, if he let him in, you know, maybe that was part of it. John Paxson wasn't going to be a threat to be an owner. John was doing broadcasting, and then he worked his way into the front office. And, yeah, he tends to be very loyal, and he stuck with them probably too long. But maybe somewhere in his subconscious, that was part of the reasoning that he felt like it was time to break it off, that it was okay, that Michael would go somewhere else and be just fine. And if he was going to own a team someday, it'd be somewhere else. But he didn't want him to have ownership in his team.
I also think it's the Waddle theory of he knows, these guys know who work for Jerry where the bodies are buried. And when they're burying, when they're in the process of burying a body, like for instance, when you start a rebuild and you sell a second round pick, John Paxson doesn't say, well, it was my owner's decision. John Paxson takes the fall.
Yeah.
You think John Paxson would rather have $3.5 million in Jerry Reinsdorf's pocket or draft a young athlete that may or may not, you know, make the team? And I think whether it's trading Luol Deng because you want to get under luxury tax, the front, while you're doing that, the guy who's making the trade may not want to, but he's not selling out the owner, and thus he's earned the loyalty from the owner because the owner is never questioned from the general manager.
You ever think Michael would fall on the sword like that? Probably
no,
not, right?
No. Michael was the sword. Yeah. I just feel like if Jerry was more loyal, like I think there's a short-sighted conversation here about could they have won? Like you, Carmen, have said, you like that they went out on a winning note.
I do.
Fine.
I do.
But is it short-sighted where you decide to sell everybody and you are viewed through the lens that you didn't give a championship team forever a chance to win a seventh? And if they would have lost, but you would have remained loyal to Michael and found a way to keep Michael here and not in Washington, and even though there could have been bad years, and even though you could have given Michael power that you may not have wanted, could that have helped your investment even more and helped your reputation even more in the next 20 years?
That's a good question, because maybe it changes the perception that's out there. That's true, because there does seem to be something negative hanging, a cloud hanging over the franchise because of the way it ended. You asked, do we fully appreciate MJ's final game, not just the last shot? That's sort of the thing that we remember most, that singular moment. But there was so much more. I think that's a good point you make, because it's easy to forget Michael had 45 in that game. This is a game six on the road against the great Utah team. He's 35 years old. He's playing on fumes, and his running mate has a bad back and plays like 20 minutes in that game. That Michael had 45, and I think it was 16 of the Bulls' points in the fourth quarter, is remarkable, Sylvie.
Shout out to Tony Kukoc, because I'm going to hear from the Tony Kukoc guys, because Tony doesn't get the credit ever. We love Tony.
Love him.
And he had a great game six. But yes, what did they score in that game? Like 85 or 88?
Something like 80. Yeah, 86.
It was in the 80s.
It was in the 80s, yes.
So Michael scores more than half of his points in a closeout game. I want to see through the record books who's done that. Can we dig that up? Has that ever been done? Like, he scored more than 50% of his total points, and this is a guy where everyone's yelling, Michael was done, he was running on fumes and everything. He scored 45 in maybe the last 45 seconds of a championship. So remember, they hit the three-pointer. Stockton hits a three-pointer. Utah's up three. Michael drives through traffic in like 6 or 7 seconds and makes a contested layup The Bulls are down one. They go underneath to the basket and go to Karl Malone, one of the all-time greats. Michael comes from the weak side, strips it cleanly. Not only strips it, the peanut punch before the peanut punch. He recovers his own fumble, the fumble, and he comes down court, keeps the basketball, or they passed a couple times, gets it back, takes Brian Russell, and makes the shot. Think about that. A driving layup in traffic, a steal from one of the greats of all time, recovers the steal, goes down court, and makes the shot.
It's perfect.
Can you think of a better 45 seconds and a better game in total in sports history than that? And we all go to Michael hitting the shot to the last dance and how it's over, but I don't think we truly stay in the moment and understand what that dude just did in that moment.
It like sums up his whole career, right? It's like you said, it's the quick drive past Brian Russell for the basket. It's the steal. It's like it's knowing what Utah's going to do, lulling Karl Malone into a false sense of security, being strong enough to swipe the ball away from Karl Malone, because even if Karl Malone wasn't anticipating it, like Karl Malone was the strongest dude on the block, you know? And I mean, like, it wasn't easy to poke the ball away from Karl Malone to be able to do that, come up with the ball, and then come down and calmly just, you know, with one of those killer little step back mid-range jumpers that he used to have. I mean, like, that's a perfect encapsulation of his whole career, basically.
I want to know, Carm, if there's an analytics guy like Nitzberg who could find me a championship performance in any sport on par with that.
Well, we could certainly, we can have Nitzberg do the research on the NBA. Like, has a player ever accounted for over half of his team's points in a closeout game? We should look at it on the road, too. I mean, he did that on the road.
And then closed it out with a final last, like a shot with under 10 seconds.
It's crazy.
Think about that.
Yeah.
And a big steal with under a minute.
I know. That's the other thing. That's why, like, offense, defense, everything that made Michael great. A couple more. Scotty, I agree with what you asked earlier when you were rattling off the questions. Like, Scotty still doesn't regret that? Like, how could that be? How could they give him this opportunity all these years later to say, you know what, I really fucked that up? And they, like, they handed it to him, right? I mean, it was right there for Scotty, and he's like, I'd do it all over again.
I'm Scotty Pippen. I am one of the greatest 25 players ever. I feel that I am getting the proper respect that now people have appreciated what I did at the point forward position, how I was this great two-way player, how nobody could guard the ball better than me, from Magic to Mark Jackson to whomever, could play multiple positions, I could shoot from distance, I could drive, I had the best dunk in Bulls history. I'm all of that. But guys, do you know what? Like Carmen just said, I fucked up. And I wish I had that back. Because I wish I went into the game and made the pass to Tony, and he hit the shot. Now, granted, I'm still pissed at Phil, because there's no way Phil would have drawn up a play in a great season that Michael had for Tony in that situation. So I wanted the same respect that Phil gave Michael to me, and I wanted the play to draw up for me. But I can't stand here saying that I could ever advocate sitting out of a championship game in the final 1.8 seconds. So for that, guys, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, look, and if he's apologizing afterwards in the locker room, like, did he mean that apology or not then? If he would have done it all over again, some have tried to rationalize. And I love Scotty. I know Sylvie does, too. I mean, I really, and I've always heard from all the guys that play with him amazing things about Scotty Pippen. I mean, truly, what a great teammate he was. In that moment, he really screwed up. He let his team down. You know, he brought Bill Cartwright to tears. And if he's apologizing after the game all these years later, why is he not more remorseful? And some have rationalized it as, well, maybe he meant I would do it all over again, because maybe if I took the shot, I wouldn't have made it and we wouldn't have won, that Tony made the shot. I think that's a reach, to be honest. I just think Scotty being Scotty, you know, he wants to be defiant to the end, it seems like, you know?
And look, I'd love for him to stand up and say, you know what, screw all of you. I did tip waitress as well. I'm not no tipping Pippin. That is unfair. And oh, by the way, all this shit you guys are giving me for a migraine, have you guys ever had a migraine where you feel nauseous and you can't see straight? So screw you for ripping me about that. But the 1.8 seconds, I can't defend. I'm sorry.
Right.
I would do it all over again. That's it. And I would stand up and say, Bravo, Scotty, and you are one of the all-time greatest athletes in Chicago sports history, and now one of the greatest mistakes in Chicago sports history. I love that you stood up and you apologized to everybody.
A couple more here before we wrap it up. Pizzagate. I found episode 9 to be interesting, and we've heard the stories here locally for years. I think nationally that made some news, but we've heard for a long time that it wasn't the flu, that it was food poisoning. Now, I had heard that it was from room service. They shot that down in the documentary saying, no, room service was done for the night. You know, wherever, where'd they used to stay, Sylvie, in Salt Lake or in Park City?
Park City.
In Park City.
At least that year. I think they may have moved in 98. Don't quote me, though.
And, you know, I don't know. I've never been there, but we've been to smaller towns. Not everything's like Chicago or New York or L.A. Most towns around the country by 10 o'clock do sort of shut down. Smaller towns, you're not going to find the endless opportunities to have food and drink as you would in a big city. So I have no doubts that they were scrambling trying to find a pizza place to get Michael some food. But a few other questions that something to me doesn't make much sense. When Tim Grover and George say that five guys showed up, well, why would five guys show up? Did you call and announce that, hey, we're ordering a pizza for Michael Jordan? No, they would never do that. And why would the guys at the pizza shop just assume that the hotel calling for pizza with 500 rooms in it must be a Bulls players or Michael's? I don't get that. A lot of the story didn't add up. Why did nobody else eat? Did Michael really spit on the pizza? Did Pizzagate really happen, or is this just a convenient story?
Grover told us on the air yesterday it did happen, and Grover insists, no matter what the pizza guy says, that there were five guys and it wasn't only two. Grover said, as his nutritionist and his trainer, that if he would have thrown the pizza out the window, even though he was suspicious, that Grover would have been thrown out the window by Michael as well. Grover also said that there was no chance that it was a hangover game, saying that Michael played every single game of three seasons of the three-peat, and that there was no way in a game five after losing two in a row that he was going to get shit-faced drunk and then go out and play that sick. So those are what Tim Grover's saying. Now, I don't know. Why wouldn't Tim Grover go down and get the pizza?
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of like the standard now. They don't even let them up to the players' wing. Like, if the players are staying in a hotel, wouldn't the front desk always say, well, let me call and we'll have someone come down?
Right. Yeah, that's the other thing. How are they getting up to the door? You're right. That was very suspicious, very crazy. I guess we'll always wonder, another one of those conspiracy theories, are they always just defending Michael and is it a convenient story? But we'll take them at their word for now. And you asked another one about Horace, too. Was Horace the leak or one of many? We know Sam well enough, and he sort of talked about in the documentary. Sam is a very respected, very well-regarded journalist. He was an investigative journalist early on. He does hold himself to those standards, and he wasn't going to write a book like that just from getting information from Horace Grant. Now, he might have gotten a lot, and he could have vetted it with other guys, but you know Sam must have been hearing things from all kinds of players back then.
Yeah, and Horace was known to not be happy with some of the stuff. I'm not going to accuse him because I don't want to take the beating that he gave Michael on Cap Show. But you know, there was just some weirdness where he cited the two sources. Like, how did he know that? And almost made him sound like, well, I was only one source.
I was half. Yeah.
I wasn't the only source. I mean, like, I had always heard through the years that it was Johnny Bock, but I guess there was an article that came out. Someone sent me an article that said maybe it was Phil, or that Phil was the one who did it, you know, to kind of get Michael to Michael's head. I don't know. I mean,
we'll never know, will we?
I'm okay with hearing some of the truths. Like, I remember reading that Michael would drive the lane and he would intentionally fire a bullet pass to Bill Cartwright just to prove that Cartwright's hand sucked. You know what I mean?
It's unreal.
I mean, I like hearing all that stuff.
Michael
doesn't, but it was the truth, so I don't blame him.
Hey, we should all be searching for the truth, and Sam's book is great, and it's an all-time great, and yes, you're right. It was good work by Sam then. It continues to be good work, and yes, we want the truth, absolutely. All right, so did we miss anything, or is that all the stuff
we got?
That we have?
I mean, like, I think we went longer than we even said we were going to go. Do you have a question?
I had the stuff about Michael's friends. I was wondering if you think that, is there ever a moment that Michael was truly at peace? You know, when you're so competitive, when you're so combative, when you're always pushing yourself and you're pushing others to try to keep up with you when you live that kind of lifestyle. In a way, the way he led, the lifestyle he led off the floor, the gambling, the rush that he got from it, the golf, everything was competitive. Everything was a battle. Can someone like that ever truly be at peace, you think?
No. I think the short answer is no. I don't. I think, like, he still got these grudges 30 years later. I don't think he's at peace.
So did he truly enjoy the ride? I mean, I guess when you're winning all those titles, you'd have to say yes. But do you think Michael ever truly enjoyed the ride and
yes,
his impact on he's a cultural icon. I mean, there's a lot of impact there.
Yeah, circling back to no one loves being himself more than Michael, too. I still think that while, you know, there are things that he loves being himself. He loves living this way. He loves being that way. Really quick, and you guys can cut this out if we went too long, but one question I wanted to ask Waddle that we did not cover yet. What 30-year, 25-year debate that came out of this was your favorite?
Oh,
was
man.
It like Isaiah not shaking hands? Was it Scotty's 1.8? Was it why they didn't give him a chance for a seventh?
I think the gambling stuff in the early 90s leading up to the first retirement, and my opinion very much changed over the years. I've been honest about that. I was a young kid. I was in high school when all this stuff was first going on, and I think that it was easy for us to read that in the newspapers and simply believe it, but it could have been an example of journalism run amok, let's face it. If maybe fake news before fake news. None of that was ever really substantiated, ever. And as I got older and I got into the business, and we've known people, Sylvie, and we talked to people that covered those teams, and the more people I talked to that would say to me, are you crazy? The league was going to suspend Michael Jordan? There's no proof. There's not one shred of evidence. You really think that something like that could be kept quiet for all these years? I did do a 180 on that in my life, and so it was kind of fun to go back and relive some of that. But a lot of people and a lot of my friends, like just guys in the neighborhood, as we've talked about or shared text chains about it, still want to believe that, no, it doesn't make any sense. Michael wouldn't just walk away. He must have been suspended.
Yeah, people get mad when you bring that up. People get very, very mad. I don't believe it, but I can believe it. I don't rule it out, is the way I'm going to phrase it. And I think, Carm, just to wrap up, the happiest guy when where we sit now with Horace going after Michael is Isaiah. Because when Isaiah was sort of like the villain early on with the handshaking and whether that was right or wrong and him playing coming across like he was victimized, not being put on the Olympic team, that I think he's pointing out that Michael had bigger issues within his own team than with me as someone who was on the Bad Boys.
He's saying, I told you so.
Yeah.
I told you guys.
with that big grin on his face.
With a big grin, yeah. I told you guys. Yeah. So. What'd you call it? You said that. What did you call it?
What did I say? I called it that sly grin. I was surprised he took such offense to that.
That was great. I love it.
He's always,
that's exactly
he's
what
an
it
assassin.
Was. All right. Good stuff, my man. That was excellent. Hope everybody enjoys it. The Last Dance was a fun ride, wasn't it? Maybe not perfect, but it was still a fun ride.
And Arturis Karnishevas, I hope you were watching, and I hope you can restore the greatness.
I agree. Mark Eversley, Karnishevas, get to work, everybody.
Shout out
to you guys is right. So thanks for joining us. The Unanswered Questions, The Last Dance podcast. For Sylvie, I'm Carmen. We'll see you next time.